This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehi Suhib coming up on Africa News Tonight.
What we're talking about is a practice which is steeped in tradition, steeped in history, and one which is really a global practice. We often tend to associate it with parts of sub-Saharan Africa, parts of the Middle East, but the reality is that today it's found just about all across the world.
That's Simon Ingram of UNICEF talking about female genital mutilation. Today is the International Day of Zero Tolerance for FGM. Details coming up.
Also, Burundi's president accuses former colonial ruler Belgium of ethnically dividing the country, and the United States is extremely concerned by the continuing deterioration of the human rights in Zimbabwe.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story, Italy's Coast Guard says it rescued about 1,500 migrants from the Mediterranean Sea over the weekend. Meanwhile, Libya's government says it has blocked hundreds more migrants from leaving Libya over the weekend. Reporter Josephine McKenna updates us on the latest migrant developments and rescues.
It's a particularly high number, 1,500 migrants rescued in the Mediterranean when crossings tend to be very slow in the winter months because of the difficult sea conditions and strong winds and cold temperatures. But the Italian Coast Guard says 1,500 were rescued at the weekend, bringing to around 4,500 the total that have been saved just since last Wednesday. So that's really a large number of people making that crossing from Libya to Italy, and really another indication that we're not seeing any kind of slowdown in that mass migration from North Africa to Europe.
In the meantime, the Libyan government is claiming to have blocked hundreds of migrants from leaving Libya over the weekend as well.
Yes, that seems remarkable, but the Libyan Coast Guard says it stopped between 400 and 500 African migrants from attempting to reach Europe by blocking their passage from Libya. At the same time, however, 600 people were rescued at the weekend in separate rescues, mostly by the Italian Coast Guard. So they don't seem to be very effective in blocking this flow, and that's going to be particularly controversial given that the EU has signed an agreement hoping that Libya will be taking more action to indeed block this flow of migrants. And as we discussed before, the Europeans and the Italians want to invest more money in Libya to strengthen the Coast Guard, to strengthen security, and try and stop these migrants from making that passage to Italy.
And also, if you could just talk a little bit more about the strategy that was the main focus of the summit in Malta on Friday of breaking the business model of traffickers who are helping these African migrants to enter Italy through Libya.
The Italian government signed a bilateral agreement with Libya late last week and took that as a basis, as a strategy to the meeting of 28 European leaders meeting in Malta. They all agreed that more was needed to stop the flow of migrants. They want to break the power of the people traffickers. But there's been much written in the Italian media saying the big problem is corruption in the system in Libya, actually breaking down the power of the people smugglers who might be in bed with the lawmakers or in bed with those who are supposed to be stopping the flow of migrants makes this a very difficult problem. Now, today the Italian foreign minister said this is not a question of money. We will do everything possible to try and stop this flow of migrants. We want to support the Libyan institutions and make them more stable. We will help them in any way possible. But as we know, Libya is a divided country. There's great lawlessness there. There are questions about whether the government is strong enough to handle the people smuggling issue and really stop the flow of migrants, no matter how much European money is thrown at the Libyan government. This year, around 8,500 people have made desperate bids to reach Europe. They've been rescued at sea just since the beginning of the year, and more than 200 are either missing or feared dead. So we're still seeing this incredible flow coming across the Mediterranean, and so far we're not really seeing a sign of any kind of slowdown, and that's going to be very controversial if the European Union throws more money at the Libyan government to try and handle this problem.
That was reporter Josephine McKenna. She spoke with me from Rome, Italy.
Burundi's president has accused former colonial ruler Belgium of ethnically dividing the country. This comes as the president visited Muyanga province to celebrate the Unity Day. Moses Havyarimana reports.
26 years after Burundi started celebrating the Unity Day, every year there are still mixed reactions on whether Burundi is currently united after recent violence that erupted in 2015 and led to loss of more than 500 lives. While addressing the citizens in Muyinga province, located in the northern part of Burundi, President Pierre Nkurunziza accused the former colonial ruler Belgium of causing ethnic divisions in Burundi. He says that Burundian unity was destroyed by Belgium and that it is high time for Burundians to come together to forgive and reconcile. President Nkurunziza says that King Albert signed an agreement on 21st August 1925 when he signed the order which divided Burundian according to their size, nose and height. The Hutu are the largest ethnic group in Burundi, representing approximately 80% of Burundians. Historically, they lived as agriculturists. Under Burundi's Tutsi-dominated post-colonial government between 1965 and 2001, the Hutu population was marginalized and subordinated to the Tutsi elites. Tutsi represent approximately 19% of the national population. Mediatrice is a Burundian who had left the country 13 years ago and only came back last year.
Although we are enjoying the National Unity Day, although many family members are united, many others still have wounded. You know, these memories that are not dealt with. You know, it actually explains to the reasons why we really have to call on those who are in power to enforce the TLC program. When we're talking about national unity, we don't just unite ourselves for political reasons, but for the whole society of Burundi.
The Hutu and the Tutsi are two large ethnic groups that mainly live in Rwanda and Burundi. Although about 85% of Burundians are Hutu, the political power used to belong to the minority Tutsi. The social differences and ethnic tensions between the Tutsi and the Hutu peoples led to the political unrest in Burundi. Jean-Paul is a Burundian historian. He says that the government still has a big role to play to unite Burundians.
Unfortunately, there are still problems, ethnic problems. Some people don't want to say it openly, but we still face ethnic problems because with President Nkurunziza bidding for the controversial third term, most of them from the Hutu majority group thought that it's the Tutsis who were against. People are still united, but amongst the politicians, unity is not there.
Since Burundi gained independence in 1962, there have been two genocides in the country. In 1972, mass killings of Hutu by the Tutsi-dominated army took place. In 1994, the situation was just the opposite. In 1993, Tutsi extremists assassinated Melchior Ndadaye, the country's first democratically elected Hutu president. The murder triggered the Burundian civil war that formally ended in 2005. However, the situation in the country is still far from being stable. Moses Havyarimana, VOA Africa, Bujumbura.
In Somalia, Al-Shabaab militants have confirmed the beheadings of four men charged with spying for the government. The public execution took place yesterday after the men were found guilty by an Al-Shabaab court in the Jamami district of the Lower Juba region. Al-Shabaab's governor in the region says the men admitted they were spies and were executed in accordance with Sharia law. The Al-Qaeda-linked group carries out frequent attacks in the capital. Last month, an attack on a hotel in the capital killed at least 28 people. The militant group is also known for its brutal punishments in the region, including floggings and amputations, after being found guilty by a strict Islamic court. In related news, Somalia is scheduled to hold its presidential election this Wednesday, February 8th.
The United Nations is marking today as Zero Tolerance Day for FGM, or female genital mutilation. UNICEF, the UN Children's Fund, and the UN Population Fund say at least 200 million girls and women alive today have undergone some form of genital cutting. Most are in Africa, but it also affects women in Asia, Latin America, and some Arab states. Simon Ingram is a senior UNICEF spokesman. From Brussels, he spoke to VOA's Jody Kiapowa.
What we're talking about is a practice which is steeped in tradition, steeped in history, and one which is really a global practice. We often tend to associate it with parts of sub-Saharan Africa, parts of the Middle East, but the reality is that today it's found just about all across the world. It has been exported just as it has been maintained within societies. It's a practice which, despite enormous amount or growing amount of attention and efforts to counter it over recent decades, has proved to be remarkably stubborn. And that's why progress has not been nearly as fast as we would have liked, and why it's necessary today, the day which speaks of the zero tolerance for FGM, it's why we're speaking out again.
And how widespread is it? I know there are about 200 million women and girls alive today who have undergone this procedure, but how widespread?
Well, it does vary enormously. There are some countries where the prevalence is extraordinarily high. Countries like Gambia, for example, where it's about 56%, we reckon. Mauritania, 54%. And it's pretty high in countries like Somalia and Djibouti as well. But the prevalence does differ sharply. In other countries, it's much more contained within small subsections of society. It's a very, very varied practice, many different explanations, many different cultures which practice it. It's very hard to generalize.
Why is it so hard to stop? Give me an example of some culture where this is ingrained and almost impossible to stop.
I think it's very important to understand that when parents, when communities speak about carrying out this practice on their young girls, they do it with the best possible intentions in mind. They do it because they see this is somehow purifying their girls, protecting them against instincts which would otherwise come to the surface and which would cause them problems, make them impossible to find partners in marriage, for example. It's something which communities really believe is for the best, and they cling on to it for that reason. So I, for example, have worked in Egypt, where FGM is a very deeply rooted practice, going way back beyond the time of Islam, for example. And there you can see the strength of the passion of feeling which is generated when communities start discussing this issue. I've seen practitioners or people who advocate against FGM going into communities and ending up in furious discussion and argument with some of the elders who say that they cannot possibly change a practice which goes back so far in time and which is so beneficial for their girls. So it is an issue which generates huge heat, and that makes it very, very difficult to convince people to change hearts and minds. That's what is needed in order to root out this practice once and for all.
Have you spoken to some of the young girls who've undergone this?
Absolutely. And there are some who are very proud of what's happened to them, some who believe that it was absolutely the right thing to do. They see this as a rite of passage, as it were. But at the same time, there are absolutely tragic stories which you hear about and encounter quite frequently. Girls who suffer terrible physical trauma, who are left physically and emotionally scarred for life. And there are even instances where girls, where something goes terribly wrong and it costs them their lives. So it is a practice which comes at a heavy price. And the tragedy is that although we are seeing success in terms of pushing back the practice in some countries, because of the rate of population growth in some of the larger countries where it's carried out, we risk seeing the practice becoming even more entrenched as time goes on. That's why efforts to root out FGM must be redoubled.
So what do you do when you say they need to be redoubled? How?
One is to do more to work with the health care workers and NGOs who are very active on the ground in many countries. We can work with national governments. In some countries, a change in the law is an important measure because it sends the signal that at the national level, at the government level, the FGM can no longer be tolerated. And I think we can also work with some of the people who've been brave enough to come out and say, FGM, that's something that I underwent, but it's something that I will never practice in future. These people need to be supported precisely because otherwise they become the target for criticism and attack by those who see their own interests as being undermined.
Simon Ingram is a senior UNICEF spokesman. From Brussels, he spoke to VOA's Jody Capua.
Past the hour. This is Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. The U.S. Embassy in Harare has released a statement saying the United States is extremely concerned by the continuing deterioration of human rights in Zimbabwe. The embassy cites an example of the arrest and detention of Pastor Evan Mawarire. He had led a number of protests criticizing government policies. The statement says the U.S. government believes in the basic right of freedom of speech and calls on Zimbabwe's government to respect the rights of all citizens as enshrined in the Constitution. The U.S. also calls on Zimbabwe leaders to respect the rule of law and due process as provided in the Constitution.
For years, UN mediation has failed to resolve the dispute between Morocco and the Polisario Front over the status of the Western Sahara, following the decision by the Organization of African Unity in 1984 to admit the Sahara Arab Democratic Republic as a full member, Morocco pulled out of the organization. But last week, the African Union readmitted Morocco as a member. Mohamed Sherkawi is professor of conflict resolution at George Mason University. He spoke to VOA's Mohamed El Shenawi about possible implications of that development on the future of the Western Sahara conflict.
Well, I think there was a significant shift, something I would call a new era of political pragmatism in African politics. So unlike those heated and sometimes tumultuous negotiations in the African way, we saw a smooth process of voting by two-thirds of the members to welcome back a leading African nation to the Union. So what I also appreciate in a positive way, that is the welcome gesture from the Polisario or the so-called Western Sahara Republic. And one of their officials said that Morocco's return to the African Union means that it would now be expected to put in practice decisions taken by the African Union with regard to a referendum in Western Sahara. So we also heard the Moroccan monarch who said in his speech in Addis Ababa the readmission was not meant to divide the continental body. For the first time, there is a consensus here that we need to move forward, and there is a serious search for a political resolution of the old conflict since 1975.
But the former Organization of African Unity recognized Western Sahara as a member while most of its territories has been controlled by Morocco since 1976. Would the readmission of Morocco open the door to settle the Western Sahara dispute?
I think there is a strong growing conviction among African leaders, including North African ones, that the Western Sahara conflict should be handled regionally by some local diplomacy. So I think now we'll see in the next few months probably is a shift from the UN in New York to the African Union in Addis Ababa to contemplate the idea or a formula for a working peace process, starting with the referendum that has been delayed since 1991. The conflict will put itself on the map of the continent more than the global, you know, diplomacy. And it is also another strong dimension that would also stimulate this energy, which is the economic ties between various African nations. And apparently the Moroccan diplomacy has mixed diplomacy with the financial investments or opportunities. Since 2000, the Moroccan monarch has paid about 46, 47 visits to 25 different African countries and presided over the signature of 947 economic and diplomatic agreements. But I think 2017 is probably a wake-up call for African diplomacy to mitigate African conflicts.
Western Sahara's Foreign Minister Mohamed Ould Salik had earlier said progress on Morocco's admission to the African Union was a positive step since it would put them on an equal diplomatic footing. What's your take on that?
I think there is some recognition of political realism that we need to be engaged. This Moroccan return to the African Union without pushing or kicking the Polisario is an indicator of some good, positive engagement. And not only that, I heard that there will be a committee where both Moroccans and Sahrawis have to work together among other North African partners. So let's wait and see how this non-Cold War mindset will have the upper hand in bridging those differences and probably will pave the way for some midway diplomacy and possible settlement after the long-standing stalemate in North Africa since 1975.
Mohamed Cherkawi, professor of conflict resolution at George Mason University, he spoke to VOA's Mohamed El-Shenawi. And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yeis Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports coming up at 18:30 UTC. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Shogun Chow, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Hello, Africa. This is James Barty, host of Daybreak Africa, inviting you to join me every weekday morning at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC as we bring you the latest in African news, features, and sports. You can also be a part of Daybreak Africa through our listener mail segment by sending your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. You can also call us and leave us a voicemail at 202-205-9942. That's 202-205-9942. And when you hear the Voice of America identification, press the number 25 to leave us your message. Start your day with Daybreak Africa every weekday morning at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC on the Voice of America.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, an in-depth look at the northern Nigeria-based terrorist group Boko Haram. The militant group has targeted both Muslims and Christians, killing more than 20,000 people since 2009. VOA has exclusively obtained secret video shot by Boko Haram that identifies its operatives committing acts of terror. We'll discuss the violent organization on the next Straight Talk Africa at 18:30 UTC.
VOAAfrica.com.
On VOAAfrica.com, the news updates never stop. Our primary goal is to keep you informed.
VOAAfrica.com, your trusted source for news and information.